The series is a fascinating look at the world of cryopreservation. How did you first get interested in the subject?
Well, it's a subject I became interested in when I was at university. It was during the second year of university, towards the tail end, and we were asked to start thinking about ideas for a final major project, which is something you do in the third year. And I was interested in the writings on photography by Susan Sontag. And there's a chapter in her book where she writes about photography and its relationship with death. And she talks about how photography is a way of preserving time and life and memory and all those sorts of things. And so I became interested in the idea of photography as a tool of preservation. And I drew up a list of subjects to photograph, everything from Egyptian mummies to taxidermy to embalming, museum specimens, all sorts of things. And I thought I'd make a project, about how we human beings like to preserve the world around us. Around that time, I came across an article in the Guardian newspaper with the headline, "Freezer Failure Ends Couple's Hopes of Life After Death." And it told the story of the Martineau family, a French family, and Raymond Martineau, the father, had frozen his wife, Monique Leroy, when she died in 1987. And then Raymond's son, Remy, froze his father in, I think, 2002. But, of course, the headline was that this experiment had come to an end because the freezers had broken down. And this article mentioned the idea of cryonics and mentioned that there was two facilities in America where you could go and have this process done. You could actually have your body frozen after death. And, that was it for me. I was sort of hooked.
So over the course of 6 years, you visited those two sites in the U.S., as well as the site in Russia. And, looking through all these photographs, one thing I was surprised about was just the level of access you were actually able to get, not just with the facilities, but you actually were able to talk to people that were planning on undergoing cryonic preservation. How did you manage all that?
Well, it's got a lot to do with, I think, the fact that I photographed this subject over 6 years. So it's been a very slow process. And I think it happened to be the way I went about it, which was purely down to my circumstances, because, as I was saying, I started this project as a student, and I wanted to go and photograph this subject. And living in England meant that, it's expensive to visit America and so on. So when I came across the subject and started researching it, I tracked down a local group of cryonicists, the UK group of cryonicists, which consisted of about sort of 5 to 10 people. And it just so happened that they met twice yearly, very close to where I lived, about a half an hour drive down the coast from Brighton. And so I started photographing this group for a year. I photographed their two of their meetings. But most of the cryonics activity or their base, I suppose, was in Peacehaven at this man's house. And Peacehaven is the place that's just down the road from Brighton. So I started just by photographing, his name is Alan Sinclair and his wife Sylvia, and their equipment and their meetings and interviewing them. And then when I had the finances to make the trip to America, I applied for grants and so on. So that's how I made the trip. But I was able, I'd spent quite a lot of time with this group in the UK, and they were able to vouch for me. And I think that was the crucial thing, is that I wasn't approaching this like a normal journalist. I wasn't trying to, walk in the door and walk out. I think I demonstrated a long-term interest in the subject and wanting to do something much more thorough, a much deeper engagement with the subject. And I think that's what, I know that that's what the Kranich facilities, the people that ran them responded to.
And my understanding is that there isn't a huge market for cryonics in the UK. Is that correct?
No, that's absolutely right, yeah. I mean, cryonics is a very niche market or niche industry. There's only about 2,000 people in the world signed up to be frozen when they die. And across the three organizations which store cryonics patients, there's only about 200 people that are cryonically preserved. So it is a very small, it's a small market, a small industry.
And so eventually, as you mentioned, you visited a facility in the US. Could you tell me about the first day you actually stepped foot in the place?
Well, of course, I had no idea what it was going to look like. And I suppose my imagination had been fueled by watching science fiction films as a teenager. Films like Demolition Man and what's the other one? Vanilla Sky and things like that. So I did have quite spectacular ideas of what it might look like. And it was much more mundane, much more practical than I had imagined. So the first facility I visited is in Phoenix, Arizona, and they store the patients in stainless steel vats. They're called chillers. And they're very much like a thermos flask, really. They have a vacuum, and then the patients sit in a pool of liquid nitrogen suspended upside down. But, of course, you can't see them from the outside. It's a solid casing. So it's and the building itself is much like many other sort of industrial warehouses that you'd find in Phoenix, Arizona. There's nothing from the outside of the building to make you aware that this experiment is going on inside. It's a very banal exterior, which is probably a sensible thing.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Looking at these photographs, if you had told me it was like a chemical plant, I probably wouldn't have doubted you. It just it does, as you say, look really banal and kind of industrial in a way.
Actually, photographically, of course, I was disappointed to begin with, but I actually really like this this contrast of such an extraordinary and ambitious idea combined with the fairly banal architecture and lo-fi equipment. I mean, all this equipment has to be custom made because, of course, as we were saying, cryonics is such a niche industry. So everything is, a lot of the equipment's made in-house. Some of the equipment at the facility in Arizona is actually custom built by fabricators that they get in. But a lot of it, is designed by the guys that work there and built to meet their requirements.
Well, how far does this technology date back?
Well, the actual process of freezing, are you talking about? They've been improving the equipment ever since the mid-1960s, when the first patient was frozen. Actually, I think it was late 60s. I think it was 1968, the first cryonics patient was suspended. On my last visit to America, I actually met the man that... the only surviving member of the original group that built the first cryostat. There was three of them. Two of them, I believe, have passed away. And Ted is... I went to meet Ted on my last trip in 2012. And, the design is not a million miles away from what they were building then. It's a lot more accurate and precise now, but essentially they're metal dewars with a vacuum, and the patients were stored in liquid nitrogen just as they were in the late 60s.
And before they're even stored in these vats, I mean, how do they get to that point? What's the process like by which someone becomes preserved in this way?
Well, it varies a lot from patient to patient, but the initial stages of a cryonic suspension the patient is placed into an ice bath and cooled in water ice. And whilst that's happening, they use a thumper to inject, and they inject a series of what they call cryoprotectants. So that's sort of like a human antifreeze substance. So these are being injected and pumped around the body to try and keep the patient, well, to try and keep the patient's cells in as liquid a state as possible. Because obviously, if as you cool a patient down and you freeze something, the cells expand and break up, and that's what they're trying to prevent happening.
And as you said, this is all done with the assumption that in the future these people will be brought back to life. But, I mean, as it stands now, is there any real reason to believe that that will happen?
It's difficult for me to say. I'm not a scientist, and I'm not a cryonicist myself. I mean, there's research that's been done with a liver. That a liver, human liver, has been taken down to cryonic temperatures, and then has been successfully thawed out, and doesn't show any signs of being damaged. But of course, you know, we're all very aware that a liver is a very different organism to you know, a brain and a human being. I mean, it's a very, very long way away. As far as I'm concerned. But, I mean, it's not... I mean, I feel like my job is really to put this subject out there for discussion and thought, and to kind of question it and inspire a conversation around it. I'm not really trying to kind of predict how likely it is that this will work.
And as part of this project, you also spoke to a few people that were planning to be preserved. Did you talk to them at all about why they made that decision?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I've met a lot of people that are planning to be cryopreserved, and also I've been working on the project for so long that quite a few of those people are now in cryosuspension. I met Robert Ettinger. I went to visit him twice, actually, once in 2008 and again in 2010.
And Robert Ettinger, the
father of cryonics, exactly, yeah. He wrote the original book, The Prospect of Mortality, which was published in 1964 and is widely credited with starting the whole cryonics movement. And he was cryopreserved. He died and was cryopreserved in 2011 at the age of 91. So, yeah, I mean, his reasons for being cryonically suspended are very different to other people's. I mean, everybody has their reason, and they vary. They vary quite a lot, actually. They vary from people who are just, you know, sort of petrified of the idea of dying, to people that are just sort of, you know, in this for the adventure. They just would love to experience life in 200, 300, 400, maybe 1,000 years' time. People have very different... reasons for signing up.
Well, I'm curious, were certain explanations more popular than others? And also, for example, did it differ by country?
I wouldn't say it differed by country. I mean, I think For instance, I mentioned Alan and Sylvia Sinclair, who are the couple that live in Peacehaven, which is just down the road from Brighton. And Alan and Sylvia ran a rest home together. They ran a number of rest homes. And so they were surrounded by, you know, old age and death through their professional life. It was also interesting that Alan's job before they opened a rest home, he was a engineer. So he has this sort of background in engineering, and then he got involved with homes for the elderly. And I think just that constantly being surrounded by death on a day-to-day basis and old age, and how painful and difficult that was, made him look for some sort of alternative. And being of this sort of practical nature of, you know, he's always someone that's talked to me about how much technology has come on. You know, when he was, he's a man, I think, in his, what do I want to say, but I imagine he's in his late 70s. He's someone that's seen, as has anyone that age, has seen technology change hugely. I mean, just, you know, things are possible now that he never dreamt would be possible when he was a boy. And I think that makes him think that will continue to happen, and that cryonics is worth a shot. You know, I think the thing is, for me, when I started, is that my assumption was that sort of everybody thought this was definitely going to work. And of course, I was incredibly skeptical. But after these projects for 6 years, cryonicists are actually pretty skeptical themselves. It's just that this is, the cryonicist answer is, you know, if I want to live forever, I stand a much better chance if I'm cryonically preserved than I do if I am buried or cremated. And they just see it as, they're my choices. I can be cryonically preserved, I could be buried in the ground, or I could be cremated. And cryonics is really the only logical choice.
So within the cryonics community, it sounds like you're saying that there is this widespread acceptance that it is kind of based on faith.
Well, yeah, you see, I get in trouble for using that word. Because they see it as being a faith is, is a word we use to when we talk about religion a lot. And they see cryonics as being something very different to that, mm-hmm. because it's a practical step. It's not a spiritual step.
Well, I also wonder what effect this has on family members of people that undergo cryopreservation. I mean, you know, I wonder if it, you know, has any effect on the grieving process, for instance. Can you really accept that one has passed, or the finality of death, so to speak, if someone undergoes cryopreservation?
I mean, it's a very interesting one. And one of the things I should say is that sadly, only a few months ago, Sylvia, Alan's wife, passed away and has been cryonically preserved. And Alan is also, of course, signed up to be cryonically preserved, but no other family members have signed up, so that their son, for instance, doesn't have an interest in cryonics. But he seems to be, you know, I've met him on a couple of occasions, he seems to be fairly comfortable with the idea of his mother and father being cryonically preserved. Of course, I think that varies. I mean, there are stories of family members. This is, there's in the early days when this was even more of a niche idea, there are stories of people sort of signing up in secret, and then, you know, on their deathbed finding out that their wishes are to be currently preserved, and of course that coming as a huge shock to the family. But I think the organisations have done a lot to try and address that now. They've tried to advise people to you know, really you should be telling your friends and family as much as possible so that this isn't a big shock when you finally die. You know, they don't want this to sort of come out of nowhere because, of course, all it's going to do is delay your suspension whilst everybody comes to terms with that.
I mean, it's a really sensitive subject. I'm wondering, as a photographer, if your approach to this project differed in any way as compared with other series you might have done.
Yeah, it definitely did, because of the nature of it being about death and, you know, it being quite a sort of controversial subject. I mean, it's interesting because the project is a photography exhibition, and hopefully it will be a book next year. But having the work exhibited in a gallery, you know, it's been fascinating to see how people react to that because it brings out very strong reactions in people. I mean, of course, the strongest reaction is a lot of people think this is complete fantasy and utterly ridiculous, and why would you take the time to, you know, well, why would you spend this money on being chronically preserved and all those sorts of things. So it is something I have to be very careful about how I put that information across. I mean, hopefully I'm doing it right. I mean, I've given it a lot of thought. And actually, when I had the work exhibited for the first time, a lot of chronicists came along. And there was a mixture of criticism and kind of praise, actually, for how I'd put the project across, because the photographic style, the way I've shot it, hopefully you don't see too much of my signature in the, or my impact on the pictures. I try to make the pictures as objective as possible. Obviously, I know that's impossible because photography by its very nature is subjective. But the idea is that when you look at these pictures, they don't sort of exaggerate or shout about what they're about. They're quite still, objective pictures of the subject.
Yeah, I'm also wondering if there were any things that were off limits for you in this project. For instance, you know, I don't believe we see any bodies or heads in these photos. Was that a conscious decision on your part?
Yes, I mean, so you see wrapped up bodies, and that is actually how the patients are stored. I have photographed a frozen dead body, and you can sort of make out this person, but my concern with that picture is that it's controversial because, you know, the person in it is dead. But the real reason it's not in the series is because I think that if it was, the body of work would almost just become about this one picture. It would be a case of, have you seen the picture of, you know, if it was in an exhibition, it would be very much, you know, oh my God, have you seen the picture of the dead body yet, the dead person? And I think by not showing the actual body, you know, your imagination is kept alive. You're starting to think about other things. Hopefully you're starting to think about, you know, the kind of questions you've asked me. And it's not just about shock and reaction to that. Hopefully it's by showing the subject in the way that I have, I'm trying to provoke thoughts and conversation.
Well, I have to ask, I mean, having done this project, is this something that you would want to go through?
I've thought about it a lot. It sort of comes in waves, the temptation to sign up. And of course, I knew this question was coming. And I always sort of say, you know, a chronist once said to me, well, really, you have to sign up because you're only photographing one half of your subject. you know, if you want to photograph the other part where we're all being brought back to life, then you've got to be frozen yourself. So, you know, and I haven't acted on it. I mean, I was very tempted to sort of go through the motions, but, you know, it's not something I've acted on yet.